I wanted to take a moment at the start of this episode to say this will be our last episode for 2021. And Fintan and myself wanted to wish you, as they say across the pond, happy holidays. Whatever you celebrate, even if you don't celebrate anything, we hope you get some good time off. We hope you see some family and some friends and share some love and some good times. I was hoping to say something pithy and heartfelt, maybe something piquant about 2021, but 2021 can suck my ass. The big positive from the year is that the gambling industry has shown that it can really bounce back. So hopefully things will be good for everybody in 2022. We'll see you there. Hello, welcome to the Gambling Files RTFM, the podcast the industry never knew it wanted and is still unsure about. I'm your host, John Bruford. I'm usually your co-host. Fintan's not here. He's doing big and important business things, too important for the likes of you and me. I am joined today by my first guest, who knows, maybe my only guest, Steve Ruddock. Steve is content director for Betting USA and editing... editor-in-chief of the Gaming Law Review. So a very busy and important person himself. Steve, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, I contacted Steve using the magical medium of LinkedIn because I saw he'd shared an article on Betting USA with his five predictions for US sports betting in 2022. Now, I'm sure as an industry, most of us are watching what's happening from outside America and looking at it and going, well, that's crazy. But Steve, I'm assuming you're an American. Are you an American?
Yes, I'm an American. I did live in Germany for a couple of years, but otherwise 40 plus years over here.
Nice. Germany's a great country. So as an American living in America, covering sports betting in America, is it as crazy as it looks? Cause it all looks a little bit Wild West right now.
No, it's a lot crazier than it looks. And it's a very interesting situation over here for a number of reasons. Most importantly is our gaming laws are very outdated. So none of them cover internet in any way. So we kind of shoehorn a lot of our pre-internet gaming laws to the internet, and it causes even more problems.
Is it sort of the state where state? I need to be careful how I use that word in a conversation about American gambling. But is it similar to how, or is there any similarity, I should say, to how often, even globally, newly minted gambling jurisdictions will often look to Nevada for their blueprint? You know, is everybody looking to Nevada for their iGaming blueprint, or to, I don't know, New Jersey or wherever? Is there anybody that sort of set a template?
Yeah, I would say New Jersey has on the online gambling front. Nevada's laws are a little on the weird side themselves. So sports betting, even for a mobile app, you have to go to a casino to register your account in person. Nevada also has a very low tax rate at 6.25%. Most states would not want to copy that. They want more money than that from sports betting. New Jersey really did a good job with online gambling and online casino and online poker back in 2013. I think they had a pretty good model, pretty competitive market. They didn't overdo it in the legislation, so they allowed the regulators to regulate, which is something we can touch on more later on. But in the U.S. is usually you have your law and then any gray areas the regulators take care of. And New Jersey's lucky that it has a pretty good regulatory system with the Division of Gaming Enforcement.
Well, I think, I want to go through your five predictions. Do we start at one or do we start at five?
We could segue right into five, couldn't we?
I don't know. I mean, I know it's written one to five, but you know,
these are your predictions. Could go in reverse order.
We could do that. Where are you from, Steve?
I'm outside of Boston, so the accent will give it away in a little bit.
Yeah, you just said something just now, and I thought he's from Boston. Do you know? Can yeah. I tell you? I'm going to share a slightly crap story with you, which I do sometimes on this podcast. But I met one of my writers was visiting the UK with her husband. She named Sharon Harris. She lives in Pennsylvania. And she'd come over and they were doing this tour of the United Kingdom. They were going to all these lovely places. And I went down and met them in a small, I think it's a small city actually called Bath. And it's a beautiful place. And I met her and we were having some lunch and somebody else from their tour came in. And Sharon was like, oh, that's such and such. They're from Boston. And I went over to this very distinguished looking lady. I'm like, yeah, so you're from Boston. It's nice to meet you. And she was chatting away and I said, I can speak Bostonian. And she's like, oh, really? Really? I said, well, I can do a little bit of the accent, but I can only say sort of three words. So what are they? I said, well, I can't really say them to you because you're a lady. She's like, no, go on. I'm from Boston. What are they? And I said, you fucking bastard. And she was like, oh my God, you can. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's an interesting accent. Most people will do the park the car.
Oh, yeah, I never would have thought that. Yeah. But, you know,
we have a problem with ours.
Some great things have come out of Boston, though.
And the accent isn't one of them.
Do you know what? I like it. but, you know, I'm pretty sure that in the top five list of great things that have come out of Boston, Cheers is probably in there for most people.
Yeah, that was a good show. It doesn't resemble the bar itself in any way. So it's people, I think, get let down when they actually visit it and expect the bar.
I think you just described life, didn't you?
A letdown, so, yeah.
You know, fun. Like you're at school and being a grown-up looks great. You get to being a grown-up and it sucks ass.
Get me back to school.
Basically, yeah, I'm trying to get that into my kids now. No. Stay there. Get held back as many years as you can. We could go to number five. I want to go back to something you touched on about New Jersey. Has the New Jersey legislation evolved from what they did in 2013, or did they just get it right, which is pretty much unheard of?
Yeah, it's evolved a little bit. So they've made some tweaks, some changes. Because it didn't stipulate a lot of the specifics, the DGE has had to make determinations themselves for things like esports, how to deal with book errors, things of that sort. So there's been a learning curve with all of it, but for the most part, they had a really, really solid law. I think not only the DGE, but the government officials who created the law itself did a really good job of talking to the industry, going overseas, getting best practices from over there. Back at the time, there wasn't a lot in the U.S., wasn't a lot of media coverage of any of this in the U.S. So it was a difficult proposition for them. And they did a good job of kind of outsourcing it to European regulatory bodies.
It's just so rare to hear somebody say, yeah, they did a good job. Which I know that sounds super negative, but, you know, we're talking about the gambling industry. It's the easiest puppy to kick.
I say that in this episode.
Do you know what? I'm going to remain optimistic. Anything could happen. So let's go to number five. Let me just get this on my screen here. There it is. Let's go to number five. Number five. And we should do this like a chart countdown. And in at number five, Steve Reddick's predictions. Regulators under the microscope. Steve, take it away. What's that all about?
Yes. My big concern in the U.S. at the moment is a very green regulatory industry in many states. So we talked about New Jersey and how they have a very sophisticated regulatory body. Nevada has a very, very good regulatory system. But even in those cases, I would say that they're overly slow. So New Jersey early on had to approve every promotion, and that took time. So operators weren't innovating with their promotions because it had to go through a 2-week review process. So by the time they wanted to roll it out, whatever they were trying to promote, it's already over. Other states, it's even worse. So you have a state like Tennessee, which has no gambling whatsoever, pretty much, before they legalized mobile sports betting. So they hopped right into mobile, no retail, no nothing. had to create a regulatory body that could oversee this. And what you get is a lot of political appointees. And we've already seen how that's played out in Tennessee, where they licensed basically a payday loan lender to operate a sports book. And it turned out that allegedly, I'll make sure I put that word in there, that they were basically using people's loan payments to pay sport. They were letting people take loans to make sports bets, was the allegations. And it was kind of a vicious cycle when you're talking about loans with huge percentage rates on them. They're short-term loans, so the percentage rates are through the roof. So I think you already see that we've had a couple of slip-ups on the regulatory front with some of these states that just aren't well-versed in gambling.
Yeah. I mean, in any industry, you expect errors. You expect, because people will always find a gap, won't they? Businesses will always find a gap. They'll always find
exactly
some way to exploit or game the system, whatever the system is. And even if the system is set up to be good for everybody, somebody will still find a way to stick their dick in it. But
that's exactly what happened with daily fantasy sports. So the U.S. government passed the UIEGA law.
That's catchy.
Which went after online Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act in 2006. So they were going after the payment processors of offshore poker sites and casinos. And in that law, they had a carve out for fantasy sports because they didn't want to ruin anybody's, you know, social fantasy league. Well, some very smart people saw that and said, you know what? We could make something called daily fantasy sports, which, in my opinion, is just a version of sports betting. Some people can argue that point. I won't do that. And that was the workaround. And we see that with pretty much everything. Like you said, they make a regulation, a company works around it. We have, in the US, we have something called sweepstakes betting. And there are a couple of sweepstakes betting sites. So you're allowed to offer a sweepstakes as long as the entry is free, but you can also charge for entries. So we have a casino and a poker site that you can get free tokens from them by mailing something in, or you can just purchase those tokens. So what do you end up with? You end up with people using it as a real money gambling site. So it is always a workaround, and the US laws are so antiquated and outdated and often contradictory, it just causes all sorts of problems.
Yeah, that's that's pretty shit, really. Because you've got this. It's an opportunity. There's no two ways about it. There's an opportunity to get it right. There's an opportunity to look at every single country that's done iGaming and to say, well, that worked, that didn't work, that didn't work. To just look at Sweden and Germany now, to just take those as examples. For example, they both came in with very, very strict legislation. It's a shame Fintan's not here because he did some research on this, which is really interesting. But the research he did, it was just basically on internet search terms and how people actively searching for offshore gaming went through the roof because of the sudden restrictions on the iGaming for licensed operators in those countries, which means tax dollars are going straight out the country. It means player protection's gone to shit. It means nothing good all ends up. The US had this fantastic opportunity to learn from all of our mistakes and then kind of didn't bother, you know?
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation over here. I mean, the simplest, quickest way to have gotten it right would be federal legislation, but gambling has always been handled at the state level. So we could do sort of a lowest bar type of thing at the federal level and then have states build on that through their own laws. But there's always a reticence to let the federal government get into anything. So I have a even very long time industry person, Richard Schutz, is very fond of saying you can't let the camel's nose under the tent. And if you have the federal government writing a law, even if they have good intentions to just set baselines, there'll always be the lobbyists and special interest groups looking to get their specific policy put into it. And the next thing you know, it has all different carve outs and different measurements for different states based on whether it's population or who knows what the metrics are. It just always becomes a problem at the federal level.
You know, like when it costs X billion dollars to run a presidential campaign, then politics is always going to be for sale. That's a friggin' issue, frankly, in my humble opinion. Not talking about presidents specifically, but any kind of campaign run in the US that is political needs such vast financial backing that that leaves people wide open to influence like this. Because the principle that we're talking about works really well in the European Union. You have essentially a federal baseline law. It's happened with tobacco as well, the Tobacco Products Directive. And these laws are constantly reviewed. Is it working? Does it need updating? Is there a loophole? Is there a new product? And these things are key. You've got to kind of keep monitoring, keep regulating, keep stay in the loop. You can't have a situation where, okay, in the UK, we had the Gambling Act in it's called the Gambling Act 2005. I don't think it actually happened in 2005. I think that's just when it was drafted. But it came into play around that time. When it came into play, it was already out of date. You know, and because of the way laws in the UK work specifically, it remains out of date. It's being reviewed now for revision next year. That's like 16, 17 years of a law being in place that was out of date from day one. It doesn't have to be that way, but unfortunately, and I understand why people are keen for federal level laws to kind of not happen. Nobody likes the idea of a police state or a nanny state. But actually for something like gambling, it's a huge help. And it sets laws which companies coming into the industry will find much clearer. It makes entering into an industry so much easier if it's like a common baseline entry to every state. But yeah, you know, what the fuck do I know? As I like to say, I can't even hang on to my hair, Steve. I have none.
Yeah, you'll get no disagreement from me on that.
What about my hair?
we're not on video, so I can't really comment too much on that.
But it would be fair because a fact, you know?
Yeah, but to the point of everything coming down to money, this is even true at the local level, not even the state level, at the state and local level in the U.S. I mean, Pennsylvania is a good example. So they had, when they passed their law, they had 12 casinos. This was back in 2009, I think. I'm way off on that. But 2018, or right around there, 18 or 19.
It's a multiple of nine.
Yeah, it's either 18 or 19. And when they passed their online gambling law, it was a 3-4 year process. It started in 2015, and every legislator who had a casino in their district basically was taking that casino's position on how this should be done. So you end up with this really strange law that has a 54% tax rate on online slot machines, 36% on sports betting. You can only, if you have a skin, it has to say who the main license holder is somewhere on the, it's just an overly complicated law that didn't need to happen, but it's an issue at every level of government in the US, and the more casinos a state has, the worse that's going to be. Typically over here, it's a little different how casinos are over here. Typically what happens is the casino pays state taxes to the state, but they also usually pay a local tax, not only to the city they're in or town they're in, but to surrounding communities. So there's always a fight about what constitutes a surrounding community, because the town that's, you know, two borders removed start saying, well, you know, actually it's quicker to get to our town than it is to get to the town that's only one border removed because of Trump, whatever. And it turns into basically a cluster of arguing, and you get a really shitty law out of it.
In which everybody wins.
Yes. Well, especially the consumer.
Yeah. If you're a toilet paper manufacturer, you're fine. So in at four, operators throw in the towel, Steve.
Yeah, this is a big one for me. So in 2013, legal online poker came to the U.S. I use my air quotes there. Can't see that. Came to the U.S. and you had three sites. So you had Ultimate Poker. Why can't I think of the other one? You had the Party Poker Network. And then you had, there's a third one there. I'm forgetting. Oh, 888. Sorry. We're at WSOP.com. You can see how important online poker is in the U.S. at the moment. I can't even keep that straight. Ultimate Poker was the first one. They launched in Nevada in April. I mispronounce that state all the time and people get mad. They launched in April 2013. They were shut down a little over a year later. They just spent too much money, realized that the opportunity they thought was there wasn't there. I'm starting to see that in states in the U.S. with sports betting. I think a lot of people just thought all you do is you have some software, you open up a sports book, and people come and bet. And I think starting to see that it's the cream is rising to the top. I think there's still going to be some jostling for who the top operators are, but there's just not room in an individual state market for 20 operators. I mean, most of the states over here are under 10 million people. So you're dealing with a pretty small population at the state level. Some of these companies are trying to create some type of national framework, but it's still a state-by-state experience. And how can you say, oh, well, we'll pay the $10 million licensing fee in Pennsylvania and pay them 36% tax, which works out to, I think, about 24% after deductions. And how is that a viable model? And how am I going to replicate that in every state? And because of the weird laws over here, how am I going to set up servers in every state so that I comply with intrastate laws and I'm not broadcasting information interstate? So there's a lot of issues and a lot of cost going on in the U.S. sports betting market. I think there's going to be some operators that maybe thought there was a really good opportunity and they're just not finding it. And I think you see that with a lot of the M&A that's going on right now. It's, you know, people have a product, but they really don't know how to deploy it over here.
Yeah, I think that's, excuse me, there's my cold manifesting itself. I wasn't making it up. I think that's very fair. I think when you look at New York, it's kind of New York, it's, as combinations of words go, New and York together is kind of, you know, it's known around the world. It has a certain cachet. We see it in movies all the time, although I'm pretty sure it's usually Toronto made to look like New York. and, you know, it's almost like looking at New York and the proposed tax and all of that jazz, which I think is quite staggeringly high, isn't it?
Yeah, it's over 50%.
Okay. So it's almost like, you know, when you see like a fashion house bag, even if it's a really shitty one, and they always say London, Paris, New York, Milan. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if New York is going to be like that. Like nobody's really going to make any money there, but they just want it on their name.
Yeah, it's one of these things. It's considered like a gateway. Like, so if I'm a big player in the New York market, then I can take that and airdrop it into any state.
I thought you meant like a gateway drug, like sniffing glue.
My brand will be known because we're known in New York City.
Oh yeah,
you know that it's that.
That makes more sense.
Like you can't be a national player unless you're a big shot in New York type of thing. So it's sort of like when an NBA player or an NFL player has to go to the big market team. If anybody could, you know, be the superstar on you know, whatever team you want to say. I'm not going to badmouth any cities, but to really do it, you got to be on the Los Angeles Lakers, or you got to be on the New York Knicks. Or, you know, you have to make it in a really tough market. I think that's what you're seeing, but it also does. I think some of these companies do have their fingers crossed that there will be some type of national effort to, you know, make this a more seamless industry where, okay, maybe 5 years from now, there is a federal bill that says, okay, that whole thing about intrastate is gone. We're going to rewrite the Wire Act that says you can't broadcast sports betting transmissions across state lines. So we're going to redo all that. We're going to take away all these barriers that are in place. And now all of a sudden your overhead gets cut down. So I think that's what they're holding out hope for, but I'm not sure that that's going to manifest in time for many operators. And I'm not sure it's going to manifest in general. I think it might just be that sports betting becomes something in certain states like New York, Pennsylvania, becomes something that an operator hopes to break even on, and then eventually has their fingers crossed that online casino is legalized, and legalized in a much more amenable manner to their bottom line.
I think, Steve, I speak for everybody that is currently living in the world right now, including babies that have just been born during this sentence, when I say we will all be long dead before that happens. I mean, I started this with such optimism, but, you know, it's gone.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation over here with online casino. So Daily Fantasy Sports, as soon as that started becoming an issue, quickly was legalized in many states. Sports betting, same thing, very fast. Somehow online casino, which has been a topic of conversations since 2008-ish, around there, there's only 6-7 states that have online casino, online poker. And it's just not, there's something different about it over here in the US, just viewed differently, and it just hasn't caught on. When that actually happens, I don't know. I think it'll be, in my experience with this, is online casino is only legalized when a state is in desperate need of money. Most of the states that have legalized online casino have blatantly said this is a budgetary item. Couple of had a couple other reasons for it, but generally speaking, it's something that has to do with money.
Well, I think then, judging by the way that the Omicron variant is developing, we should have 50 states online by the end of 2022. There's your number one prediction, Steve.
You might not be wrong with that. It definitely showed during the quarantines over here, during the lockdowns, how quickly people would shift their spend to online.
Yeah, and it would have been much bigger if sports had still been going. I think it would have been much, much more profound if even just the English Premier League had still been going, because that's huge in Asia, huge in Africa, huge in Europe, and pretty damn popular in America. But if just, you know, if just one big league had been going, I think you would have seen silly ass numbers.
Oh, yeah.
But you mentioned something a few times in there that it bears repeating, that the Wire Act and the reasons for the Wire Act existence. I mean, it that goes back to sort of racketeering days, doesn't it? And, you know, organized crime in the US and illegal bookmaking, etc. The reasons for it existing are understandable. The reason for it remaining in existence are a bit of a mystery, if I'm honest, because I'm pretty sure even government has heard of the internet.
So, yeah, the Wire Act is one of these antiquated laws, 1961, and somehow it has gotten tacked on to internet. So it was meant for phone communications, and yes, you're right, it was meant specifically, it was a tool to take down organized crime. Was a way to get them for breaking the law, sort of like tax evasion. You might not get them for the murders, you might not get them for the extortion, but you know what? They didn't pay taxes on that money, so here's how we get Al Capone to go to jail. That's basically the gist of the law, but when the internet came about and internet gambling quickly followed, In 2002, the FBI was asked how the Wire Act, if it applied to that. And they said, yeah, we use that as a means to go after online gambling. It applies to all forms of online gambling. And in 2011, that changed. There was an OLC opinion that said, no, the Wire Act is only sports betting. There's a big debate about where a comma is placed in this law. If you read it, it's really bad grammar. It's some of the worst grammar you'll ever see. So nobody really knows what it says. It can say anything you want it to, basically. And 2011, they said, no, it only applies to sports betting. And that's how we ended up with the online casinos, online lotteries in the U.S., the few that we have. And 2018, new administration, they decided, you know what? That does apply to everything. They tried, it did fail in court. But the Wire Act still exists. It hasn't gone anywhere. And it definitely applies to sports betting. So whatever anybody says, it is applicable to sports betting based on the language of the law. It's difficult to say why it still exists from 2013 to Sheldon Adelson's passing away last year. The rewriting of the Wire Act that was tried in Congress would have made it worse. I'm pretty hopeful that now any federal action would try to make it better. I don't know if it would make it better because it's still lawmakers. And as I said, they tend to want to please the special interests.
We will be dust in the wind. But, you know, those laws that are so ambiguously worded, I once fell foul of one of those laws. So this is a true story, Steve. Can I share it with you?
I'm all ears.
It's a shitty story, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I was living in this little town, and I had this blog, and the blog was kind of a writing exercise. It was like a stream of consciousness thing, and I never went back and edited it. It was just like, pour your guts out. Did it under a pseudonym, but never tried to hide who I was. I'd never been to this town before living there. It just seemed like a nice place. Anyway, about 11 months or so, somebody found the blog and next thing you know, somebody's passing around printouts in the pub. And I'm like, oh shit, here we go. And you know, I had been scathing at times about myself, about the community, about one of the local pub landladies who I described as having skin like orange leather. And one day this policeman turns up on my doorstep and I can read his pad because of the way he's holding it. And I can see he's got my name spelled wrong. So I'm pretty sure that he hasn't found that through any sort of official searches or anything like that. I'm pretty sure it's just like a verbal complaint straight away. And he said, given that the old, is this your blog, sir? Yeah. And I explained to him that I'd already deleted the blog. It wasn't an issue anymore. And he said, oh, very well, sir. And I tried to explain how the internet sort of takes a snapshot of itself. And if you had the right search string, you could still find it.
Mm.
He really wasn't understanding it. And I realized my error in trying to appeal to his logical brain. Anyway, I then said, listen, I'm pretty sure I know who's made a complaint looking at your notes. And I think you'll find that this would be a civil law case because if I have said somebody has skin like orange leather, then that would be potentially libelous because I've done it in print and that's civil and it's got fuck all to do with the police. Is that so, sir? Yeah, and that's pretty common knowledge. Also, I'm a journalist and I can have and publish an opinion just like anybody else. If she wants to challenge that in court, good luck with proving she doesn't have skin like orange leather. and he said that the law that he was talking to me under was actually an anti-stalking law. And I said, well, you know, I am going to just go and look this up, right? And he's like, be my guest, sir. And I looked this fucking law up. And I'm not kidding you. I'm not, this isn't verbatim, but the law's wording was basically anything that upsets somebody has to be stopped. So I'm like, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get them to stop selling celery in this damn town. Because celery is just plain offensive. So, Steve, you know that 95% of the world's almonds are grown in California, right?
I do know that.
95%. That's an astonishing number. People are amazed when they find that out. Almonds need very specific conditions to grow. And they're going to be one of the big victims of climate change, as probably is coffee, interestingly enough. And I'm sure when coffee is the victim, you'll see people start to take climate change much more seriously.
Yes, I was just going to say that would definitely get people's attention.
But celery, actually 100% of celery only grows in one place.
Where is that, Steve? I do not know that.
Round the devil's ass. But anyway, I got a little bit sidetracked there, but I get what you're saying. Sorry about that. I did mention that this is quite an informal kind of podcast, didn't I?
Perfectly fine.
I haven't got Fenton here to rein me in. Steve.
Perfectly fine.
In at three, marketing and responsible gambling uncertainties. What's that all about?
Yeah, you probably know more about that than I do. But yeah, seeing what's going on across the pond, going from my direction, it just seems inevitable at this point, especially as I was saying earlier, we have this collection of states and we have different regulators who have different views on gambling. Something else you might be surprised about, some gambling regulators hate gambling over here. They're totally against it. So it wouldn't be surprising to see a state crack down. It wouldn't be surprising to see the federal government crack down. I feel like we're about one newspaper story away from somebody other than Parlay Pats ruining their life because of sports betting, that we're going to start seeing a crackdown, especially we have markets like New Jersey. New York will be like this. Arizona, where it's hyper-competitive. And the only way to gain customers is to advertise. And there's a lot of advertising going on right now. This happened with Daily Fantasy Sports. It's what kind of put it on the radar with regulators and lawmakers back in 2015, along with their ill-timed, using my air quotes again, scandal. So I can see the same thing with sports betting. All it's going to take is a really bad story about a problem gambler, maybe a point-shaving scandal, along with a glut of marketing that's happening at the same time. And I think you're going to see a lot of restrictions that the industry is not going to be fond of, because they don't seem to be of the mindset that we should self-regulate ourselves now instead of saying, Hey, let's rein it in a little bit. Let's do this. Everybody do it. But you know, there'll always be the one operator that goes, oh yeah, that's a great idea, but then doesn't go along. So gets the competitive advantage. So I think it's just a matter of time before we start to see those restrictions over here.
I think I'm not shouting into the wind. I know there's a lot of people in the industry who think similar things to what I do with this, but like I've been saying for quite a long time that the gambling industry globally, but certainly in the UK, it has to embrace and own the problem gambling side of it. Because until that happens, we can't get into the actual meat of the real argument, because it's, you know, it's pretty well established that problem gambling is a symptom rather than something that exists in isolation. And so where it's a symptom, common drivers for it are substance abuse, alcohol abuse, very much so. In women, domestic abuse is a massive driver. And the gambling industry can do nothing about any of those things. But if we take an holistic approach, and there are some groups in the UK who are doing that, who are doing interagency work and making sure people get exactly the support that they need to stop recurring issues. But until everybody's doing that, the gambling industry is a puppy that's easy to kick, and we are fucked. In the US, there's some really, really interesting and really good work going. So I think it was the episode before last, we had on two people from the New York Problem Gambling group. The group's proper title's gone completely out of my head. They were fantastic. And they're taking an holistic approach to it and getting ready for sports betting. On my old podcast, we had Judge Cheryl Moss. Have you encountered Judge Moss?
Yes, she's I'll call her a friend of mine. Responsible gambling is kind of a pet issue for me in the industry. So yeah, I'm familiar with most people.
She's a complete legend. Yeah. And but you know, like it's rare for one person to achieve that much in one single field. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, when somebody gets a Nobel Prize, it's one person's name on the prize, but they're usually part of a bigger team. But actually, Judge Moss, I think, has done something remarkable in Nevada.
And yeah, she doesn't take credit for it, though. She keeps saying, oh, well, I didn't get it put in place. I didn't get the diversion court done. But yeah, she did.
No, I bet that, but, you know, everywhere can learn from that. Literally everywhere where gambling is legal can learn from that.
Yeah. I mean, she's the program, I believe. So if anybody doesn't know, Nevada has a gambling treatment diversion court, which means it's sort of like a drug court where instead of going to jail, you enter into a program. They give you the help you need, the support you need, and they get you back on your feet. One of the key things of the program, the gambling one, is you have to make restitution to the people that you wronged, basically, no matter what it is. So it's a very interesting caveat to that program. They only have 15 to 20 people in the program at a time, but it's still, if you multiplied that out over different states and then over different court counties, you would have a lot of people getting the real help that they need. Sending them to jail does nothing. I mean, somebody embezzles money or from their company because they have a gambling problem. Sending them to jail is going to do nothing other than probably make them more of a criminal. I mean, this is somebody whose crime was done for a very specific reason. So if you can get them the help they need, I actually sat in on a couple of her court sessions where you get to see you hear the people talking, you hear the court appointed attorneys and people asking them, did you go look for work? You know, did you set up, last week we asked you if you were going to set up your a bank account. Did you do that? Okay. So did you find a place to live so that we can see about getting visitation with your kids? There's a lot going on there. It's a really great program.
Yeah. And she's a very nice lady.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. But, you know, there are really good things going on in various states, and all of these groups seem to be talking to each other and figuring out what works. Because, of course, one of the great risks when you have essentially 50 countries all looking at or in the process of or having just legalized sports betting or online gambling or one or both, you run the risk of legislation massively outpacing the support that it needs. And, you know, that's still a colossal risk for the states that are still to come on board. A little bit scary.
And as we were talking about earlier, you just see the technology outpacing the laws. So the technology is changing so fast that the laws can't keep up.
I think we just got to take that as a given now. I mean, the key thing, and what I was talking about the 2005 Gambling Act in the UK, is it couldn't possibly have predicted mobile.
Exactly.
When that emerges, you have to jump on it. You can't sit around and say, yes, this is terrible. Jump on it. Fucking do something about it.
There was a great quote from Massachusetts Gaming Commission commissioner. So this was another very newly created regulatory body when Massachusetts legalized casino gambling. And Chairman Stephen Crosby had this great line. He used to just say, laws should just call everything gambling. He goes, I don't care if you're throwing a dart at a dartboard, or you're pulling a handle on a slot machine, or you're betting on video games. Just call everything gambling and let the regulators decide how to deal with it. That way you don't have these issues of a new technology. What do we do? Well, everything's gambling. Does it have these components? Then yes, it's gambling. The regulators then decide, is this a legal form of gambling? Is it illegal? How do we regulate it? What are the best practices? And that way everything's covered and the regulators deal with it. But for that, you need very competent regulators.
I think, you know, your point about European level restrictions in the US, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I can see a bunch of states going much further than Europe because the church is still a very, very powerful influence in the US.
Depending on the region. There's certain regions of the U.S. where there's certain states in the U.S. that you'll never see gambling. That's the way it is. I mean, I'm going to stick my neck out
and say Utah.
Yeah, Utah's a good one. Of course, there's daily fantasy sports there. It's in a gray area there, so the companies operate there. Hawaii, no.
So why is that?
Hawaii has never embraced gambling because that's not the type of tourism they want. So they don't want that type of tourism. So you can imagine if Hawaii had casinos, they'd probably do very well.
I would think so.
Yeah. So they don't have a lottery. They don't have any form of gambling in Hawaii.
Is that because they're all big drinkers or what?
I just think it's just they feel they don't want to be an Aruba where most people that are visiting, yes, it's for the weather. It's for the, you know, island paradise. But the thing to do is gambling. I think Hawaii just wants a different type of visitor.
Yeah, but Aruba got mentioned in a Beach Boys song. I'm not sure Hawaii did.
Yeah, a lot of those islands did, right? Kokomo, right?
That's the one. I'm not going to sing it. You'll be pleased to know.
I will not sing it either, but I just probably dated myself a little bit.
You know, I tried to date myself, but... I'm not even going to go there.
I see where that joke's going.
It leads to a masturbation joke. Steve, number two, talk of federal action. We've touched on some of this already, but there's more here.
Yeah, 100%. So we covered this pretty good with some of the other stuff. But we're getting to a point now where professional sports leagues are kind of getting shut out in certain states. They originally wanted... integrity fee. So they basically just wanted a payment to allow sports betting, you know, to give it their blessing. But now they're kind of involved in sports betting over here. Some leagues and arenas actually can be license holders, which is very strange to me. And I just think it's a matter of time before they take their case to the federal level and they start saying, you know, this is really getting out of hand now. What can you do about this? You know, we need to make sure the integrity of sports is upheld. How do we do that? Well, let's get a sweeping blanket law from the federal level, which is much easier than trying to get it accomplished at 30 something different states where casino interests tend to have a very outsized say in how gambling laws are passed. I once heard it put very perfectly that if you dig a $1 billion hole in the ground and employ 3,000 people, you can pretty much write the gambling laws. And that's pretty much the casino industry in the U.S. in every state. So it's difficult for the professional sports leagues to use their clout, I think, at the state level around the country. I think it's a much easier job at the federal level. But I also think there's been whispers of action on sports betting since PASPA's repeal. So I think eventually we're going to see something happen. In my predictions, I didn't say anything would happen in 2022, but I'd be surprised if you didn't start getting the whispers of it, even maybe possibly some type of resolution or bill about it.
Well, it's good to have something to look forward to, right?
Yeah, of course.
Life can't always be an avalanche of shit. So we're down to number one. And let's not forget, we've done this backwards, so this is probably the least spectacular. Number one, Steve, everything including the kitchen sink.
Yeah, so this is just from my conversations with different people. Seeing a lot of innovation in the space, and I'm seeing a lot of innovation that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think people are trying a lot of different things, hoping that they stumble upon the next big thing. But it, I mean, you know this far better than I do. Sports betting, legal sports betting, has been around for a long time, and people like what they like. It's not because they really haven't had opportunities. I think in-play betting is the newest thing that's really caught on. But that's just betting. It's just, you know, breaking it down into more opportunities. So I'm seeing a lot of, I mean, you hear everything discussed. Esports is always my number one go-to on this front. It's a huge industry. This is what happens. You look at these numbers. Okay, how do we monetize that in a gambling setting? We haven't quite figured that out yet. It's something that it maybe it just doesn't have the right connection. Maybe esports is how 21 to 30 year olds spend their money and time. And when they're 40, they go to something more akin to traditional gambling. But there's basically what I'm saying is, I can sum it up probably best this way. When I first started really digging into the industry as far as regulation and legalization efforts, everybody was talking about the next big thing, which at the time was free-to-play games. Nobody could figure out. Every casino wanted them. Everybody talked about this magical word at the time. So we're going back almost 10 years. Millennials. And all I could think of as I was sitting at G2E listening to all these people tell me how casinos need to attract millennials is going, half of these people are underage and the other half aren't established and don't have much of an income. So why are we focusing on millennials when you have Gen X that is coming to your casino already? And now I'm looking at articles online where it's talking about Gen Z. They've already skipped over millennials. I'm like, well, what happened to the millennials? Well, now they're already gambling because they're older now. Yeah, they're not going to Vegas to just drink all night in a, you know, bass thumping nightclub or at a pool party. Now they might do that once, but now they're like, wow, that was a long night. I need to relax now. Because they're older. So now they've already moved on to Gen Z. And in 6-7 more years, it's going to be whatever the generation is called after that, if there is one. So it's one of these things where the innovation always doesn't match what the consumer wants. They're always innovating for some future consumer that I don't think really exists.
I think that's probably pretty fair. I think there's an element of, I keep coming back to this quote in my head because it's just popped up a few times in the last couple of weeks, the Henry Ford quote: if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. And I think the gambling industry, not entirely, I mean, there's a huge amount of innovation in it, but at the very top end, in the big, big properties and all of that, there is an inability to maneuver in a lot of ways, an inability to move fast on changing trends. And so you see a lot of the more interesting stuff in smaller properties with smaller boards, with private ownership, where there are no shareholders to appease, etc.
I've had this conversation with Alan Bowden a few times where he's very much of the mindset that, CEOs of gambling companies should have very extensive knowledge of the gambling universe. And I agree with that, but there's also a point where sometimes you just need that outside perspective. If you have the right team around you, if you're the right person. So if you took the CEO, if you took Elon Musk and dropped him into a gambling company as a CEO, as long as he was willing to listen to the people with experience, but also say, you know what? Here's this outside perspective that maybe you people have been living in a bubble about. And I think that's where the gambling industry misses a little bit. I think they're very much into hiring from within. There's a specific, every business card I have, I just throw it away after 6 months because I'm pretty sure that person's not at that same position and company anymore. They're at a new one. I feel like the gambling industry doesn't listen enough to real recreational bettors. I think their vision of a recreational bettor is somebody who comes to the casino every weekend, somebody who bets sports 3 days a week. Is just bet specific events. That's not really a recreational bettor. That's somebody who's already found themselves. To me, a recreational bettor is somebody who doesn't even know if they like gambling yet. They're trying it. They're testing it out. We're not hearing from those people. We're only hearing from the people we already have. How do we make this better for you? Well, what about this huge group of people that isn't betting? What are you doing that's keeping them away or maybe having them churn a lot faster than they normally would? And not saying that I want more and more people gambling, but I think those are the right type of gamblers, the people who are doing it for their, because it's engaging and it's entertaining to them and on some level, not because, well, I've just bet, you know, I bet the Premier League every weekend. What's the big deal? That's what I do. So I think the gambling industry could really use a nice outside perspective.
I think there's I don't know how to put this really, but this ties into what I was talking about with the problem gambling stuff earlier. That with one of the major issues with marketing to players in the iGaming space, very specifically in the iGaming space, is that so much profit comes from such a small number of players. Hmm. And they're not always the players that you really should be trying to mine for profit because they might be showing some very damaging behaviors. But while in the industry, the account managers are paid according to what they bring in, they are paid with a degree of commission in their salaries. Those people are always going to be worrying first and foremost about paying their mortgage.
Mm.
And until you take that out of the equation, the problem gambling thing is going to have one of its root causes front and center. And I do firmly believe that that's an issue. But also, do you know what? I've completely forgotten where I was going with this. There was a really involved thing that I was coming to it just then. And I've just totally lost sight of it. I've done that. I did this in the last episode as well. And I'm like, could you just like make noises like I've just said something really wise? Thanks.
I was talking about outside perspectives. I don't know if that helps in any way.
I was thinking that once you stop going after those whales, that iGaming could have that perspective of how do we attract people to have a bet where betting isn't the most interesting thing for them? How do you switch to what's essentially a mass market model, but in iGaming and sports betting? And actually, I believe that one way to, or a different way to look at this is to look at it and think, well, most of the people that go and visit a live race are not there to bet. That's not the first reason they're there. That is not their primary reason for being at that track. It's an experiential thing. And having a bet's a part of the day. But it's not the be-all and end-all. But it does mean that they can have an interest and raise the excitement levels in a race that they actually don't give a fuck about.
Hmm.
With myself, for example, if I bet, it might be on, for example, a football tournament. And I'd be far less likely to bet on a game where I care about the outcome than I would on a game where I don't care about the outcome, because it changes what's essentially a dead rubber into, holy shit, I might lose £3.
Mm.
You know, because I might only make a small bet. But if there's 60 games in a tournament and I bet £3 on a game, that's £180. you know what I mean? So there's value in those players.
It's just kind of... And even if they're throwing darts to pick the teams, they're going to get most of that money back, especially betting in that type of volume. So it's not really like a damaging thing to them.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is find the people whose first interest is in the sport and give them a reason to give it a try and to just make it a small part of that overall experience.
Yeah, using your racetrack analogy, I think that's a really good one because most people are like, so I'll just use the Kentucky Derby as an example. People go to that it's a social thing. It's a status thing. Then they bet because that's what you're supposed to do there. It's the same thing with Las Vegas. Like if you look at the visitor surveys, you see that most people are going there for a different reason and gambling is down the list. And like, I think it's something like 50 to 60% of visitors actually gamble while they're there or say they gamble. So it's not like the gambling. I think most of those people are gambling because they're in Las Vegas and that's what they've been told they're supposed to do. The people that are going to Las Vegas to gamble are a much smaller subset. Obviously, they're a bigger portion of the revenues that are coming in. But yeah, I think it's a matter of what type of customer am I trying to attract? And how does that play into my business model? I think there's a place for whales. I think in the long-term future, I feel as though the industry that's going to bite them, it's going to bite them really hard because I think that's going to be seen as very predatory down the road, engaging with customers who are gambling constantly, whether they have the means to or not.
My mum and dad went to Vegas, didn't put a single bet on, but I think that's because my mum just went to see all the strippers.
I'm a very casual gambler. I've been to Vegas many times and I probably gambled less than half of the visits. Normally I would play poker if I could organize some type of private social game. It's usually for conferences is why I'm there. Occasionally, like I'll just sit down at a 3-card poker table, but those games don't really interest me very much.
Is that because you're a poker snob, Steve?
I used to be, but no, it's more that I can think of a lot better ways to blow through a few $100s. Like I did, not that I feel the $300 is, the gambling. I can't afford that. It's just, I'd rather overpay for a meal.
Any help, if you want some tips as to where else to go in Vegas, I can get my mum to suggest some of the strip joints she likes.
I don't know how well those would line up.
I have a very kind of, it's like a, I have a sort of a face mask that my sister made for me. And it's got like this sort of jungle floral kind of decoration on it. It's very striking. And people quite frequently ask me where I got it from. I just got fed up of talking to people at one point, right in the middle of it all. And I just started saying to people, oh, my sister made it for me out of one of my mum's old stripper outfits.
And then that'll end the conversation pretty quick.
Seriously, you have no idea. Quicker than shitting myself would have done.
My response to that would be like, okay, let's hear the story.
I'd be like,
another round of drinks. This is going to be a good one.
I should have got my sister to make a really big one. Yeah, it's made out of my mum's old thong.
Outsized.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute education. If you want to catch up with some of Steve's work, the Betting USA website, it's just bettingusa.com, isn't it, Steve?
Correct.
And Gaming Law Review, which sounds pretty grown up to me.
Yeah, that's an academic journal. That's a subscription paywall type of thing. It's a print issue and online. It's a little different, very, very different than what we're used to seeing.
Sounds good, but you can catch both those things in their respective homes. Steve, thank you again for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. Fintan, when he hears this, is going to be like, but I had so many questions. And I was like, yeah, but you were busy being important somewhere else.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a blast.
And we move on to our second guest on this The Gambling Files RTFM episode. We are joined by Mr. Tom Neiman, Chicago denizen, Chicago native, Chicagoan. If you listen to the TLDR episode, you'll know exactly what Chicago is famous for in my house. I missed out pizza. Chicago's famous for pizza. Is that right, Tom?
Excellent. Excellent pizza. The beer is cold, as is the temperature most of the time. But it's a beautiful city. It sits on the lake, Lake Michigan, one of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, but that's great as in size as opposed to great because it's really good, right?
It checks the box for both of them, both great in size, great in depth, and just generally a great city to be from.
If you had to guess how many bodies might be at the bottom of that lake, Tom, what sort of number would you be guessing?
What's the over under?
Chicago was, was that not where the Untouchables was set as well?
Yes.
And as I recall, in the 1987 movie, it's very cleverly photographed. They kind of Dutch a lot of the camera angles so that you only see the historic buildings. And the Art Institute, I forgot the Art Institute. The Art Institute in Chicago is the home of Edward Hopper's Nighthawks.
Okay.
How could I forget that?
And how can I not know that?
Honestly, Tom, I'm embarrassed for you as a son of Chicago.
I am. I'll get caught up after this.
I can send you some tips of things you can go see.
Please do.
Tom, we were talking a little bit in the TLDR episode about the whole process. So there's five casino proposals to have a casino in the city. Which Correct. Is like, that's pretty massive, right?
The state has currently 10 casinos open. And they're fairly successful. Those 10 casinos, the first 9 months of this year, did about $870 million in revenue and generated about $160 million in tax. But they're adding additional casinos. There were recently... two licenses issued outside the city, and then the bid for in-city. There will be a singular in-the-city casino, and they have to generate a lot of tax revenue to cover sins of the past. So three companies have bid. Those three companies bid a total of five proposals. And interesting, the sites... what they want to accomplish at each one. But the current debate the city's gone through is with the legalization of sportsbook wagering in the state of Illinois, the city had been contemplating issuing a sportsbook license to each of the five major professional venues, home of the Chicago Cubs, the Chicago White Sox, the Chicago Bears, the Chicago Blackhawks, and the Chicago Sky, which is our WNBA entry, women's professional basketball, that just won their championship. So you've got five venues that the city is contemplating or had been contemplating allowing sportsbook facilities inside those stadiums.
So hang on a second, Tom. Is mobile sports betting legal in Illinois?
If you have an app from a brick-and-mortar casino. For example, Rivers Casino is in Des Plaines over by the airport, O'Hare International Airport. You have to have the Rivers Casino app on your phone, and then, yes, you registered there. They've got you in their books. And you have their app, then yes, you can place your wager mobile.
So you register in person at the casino?
The original law said you had to register in-person casino. When COVID broke out, the governor stepped in and they put a twist to the law and said, I believe it's on a temporary basis, you can register remotely because they didn't, they obviously didn't want people collecting at the casino. I think it was actually closed for a period of time. So you could do it remotely, but by law, technically, you're supposed to register physically at one of the casinos.
And the in terms of mobile sportsbook in the state, it's geofenced, presumably. So yes. You've just got to be in the state.
Correct. Correct. You could not cross over and be north, say, to Wisconsin and place your bet on your BetRivers casino app.
I don't understand then the appeal of having these five on-site sportsbook licenses if you can do mobile sports betting.
Well, because the people attending the game are tremendous target audience for placing a wager. If I go down to Soldier's Field, and I'm a Bears fan, and I'm going to the Bears game, and I, on my way in, go by the facility and place my wager on the Bears. But you're correct. If I have it on my phone,
you do it from your seat.
To do it from wherever you want. Now, I was just in Las Vegas for a while, and even in those spectacular sports books, they're doing it they're placing their wagers on their phone while they're sitting in the sports book. They don't want to get up, walk across, and stand in line. So
that's slightly bizarre.
Yeah, it is. So, but the people proposing the land-based casinos, the five proposals, were saying if you allow sportsbook wagering at those venues in the city, we will lose considerable revenue and you will lose considerable tax revenue.
Ooh.
So now you had the owners of the teams and the stadiums versus the proposers of the casino bits, which was Neil Bloom, who is a massive real estate development guy who has Rivers Casino in Des Plaines. He had two of the proposals, two of the five. You have Bally's. Now, as you know, there is now a new Bally's casino. The name, the brand was purchased and being run, I don't know if it's a South Korean. I believe he is South Korean, the CEO of the company. But it's using the name Bally's, which is a long, long term Chicago brand, because Bally's pinball and Bally's slot machines were made here in Chicago.
Some of your history there, Tom.
So I spent a long, long time with that corporation. Of course, it was folded into another, but the name Bally's was purchased to be taken out to build a new chain of slot casinos. So the Bally name here in Chicago is a very strong name, although it's not the original Bally company. But they submitted two. And then the third one was submitted by Hard Rock. So those are the three corporations that are bidding on the five proposals for the city. And, of course, they did not want to have these sports books available. They want customers to have to come to their casino in the city to register and to place wagers. So they were saying it's a significant, and that's the issue. Would sports books detract a significant amount from a full casino?
Would they, Tom?
I think there is some percentage of it. How significant it is, I'm not quite sure. But the city, in its chaos, answered that by granting the permission for the sports book. So now the five casinos have been granted the ability to have on-premise physical sports book at their venues.
It just all seems unnecessarily complicated.
Believe me, It's politics. It's Chicago. It will be unnecessarily complicated. There's no, nothing goes through simply, cleanly, logically. Everything is complex and everybody has got their hand out. I mean, when this issue arose, every political hack in this city got into it, trying to defend one position to the other, trying to be retained by the casino developers or by being retained by the sports team's owners. So this is how this city functions, chaotically.
Well, it is the five proposals. I don't quite know how to phrase this, so I'll just blunder my way through. Is the site decided for those already?
No.
Or so it's not five proposals for a site that the city is saying, hey, we could put a casino here.
No.
They have to find their own site, buy it, and build it.
Okay. The proposals ranged in physical locations to the various spots in the city that they felt would give them advantage in the consideration of their proposal. Most of them work around the lakefront and McCormick Place. As you know, that's our exhibition conference center. McCormick Place is a massive, I think it's one of the largest, certainly in this country and maybe in the world. McCormick Place is a massive exhibition hall on the lakefront.
Is it big enough to host ICE?
It would put ICE in one of its corners. Ooh. And so in and around it, one of the proposals was for the McCormick Place marshalling yard, meaning that's where all the trucks head into when they're coming in and going out, and they all collect. It's to the south of McCormick Place, and they were going to take over the marshalling yard. I didn't read where they're going to put the trucks, but they were going to take over that space and build a hotel casino on it. Another one is just to the north of McCormick Place called Lakeside Center. And two of those competing bids both use that site. Another one was just to the west of McCormick. It was going to extend over. We have a massive railroad collecting point just to the west of McCormick Place. And they weren't, you can't eliminate that, those tracks, but they were going to virtually build over those tracks and build a casino. So three of the sites are approximate to being north, south, and west of McCormick Place. So it was tied into it.
Is McCormick a factor insofar as you've kind of got guaranteed a sort of percentage of hotel rooms, you know,
you have rented both hotel to rooms, space? But the key is the casino is to generate revenue from visitors. Tourists, you would have the best opportunity because you have all these people who come to McCormick Place for shows, and it would tap less into local people and more into visitors, tourists to the city if it's in proximity to McCormick Place.
But surely the appeal of putting a casino in Chicago is that massive concentration of people that live in Chicago. Am I being naive, Tom?
Well, as I said, there are 10 existing. There are three new being built in and outside of the city, in and around the city. So today, much of the population that is considered the Chicago market, that means the city plus its suburbs, has some proximity to an existing or a being built today casino. The one in the city was far more targeted to a tourist or visitor audience than the ones that are out in the state.
Okay. I guess that does make sense. I mean, it's, yeah, if it's structured anything like London is, and of course not all cities are built the same way, then, you know, London almost doubles its size in Greater London. And yeah, well, Christ. Anyway, Tom, when could all this actually be concluded by?
The decision was made, they're going forward and they are going to license those sports venues. And from those, they have a tax structure that added 2% to the city. So in total, those proposed venues will be taxed out at around 20%. 15% goes to the state, 2% goes to the county, and 2% goes to the city.
This is the five sports venues that want sports betting on site.
Correct. Wrigley Field, United Center, Guaranteed Rate Field, Wintrust, Soldiers Field. Here's an interesting side story. Soldiers Field. The Bears have been playing there for quite some time, forever. Soldiers Field was, I think, part of, God, was it a Summer Olympics back in the 1920s or something? It's this big old stadium that sits right on the lakefront for the Chicago Bears. They were arm wrestling with the city about, let's get started and build our sportsbook venue. It's owned by the city. It's owned by the Chicago Park District, the physical building, the land that it sits on. And the Park District wasn't budging and didn't want to allow a sportsbook to be built on Park District land. The Bears have gone off and secured a new site. It's the Arlington Racetrack, home of Arlington Racetrack for horses, which has now been closed out in the suburbs. And they're threatening to build a whole new stadium out there for the Chicago Bears. Of course, it would have a sports book built into it. Now, I'm not saying that the only reason they were looking for a new site was because of the sports book. They obviously want a new stadium. And the city doesn't want to build a new stadium. It has this old, creaky building that is Soldiers Field, and they're holding on to it. So now the Bears are threatening to leave Chicago, go off to the suburbs of Arlington Heights, and build a state-of-the-art multi-billion-dollar stadium. And oh yeah, if they'll be able to put a sports book in it also. So. That's one of the crazy side stories, and you go, oh my God, I can't believe that the Bears would ever leave Chicago for a suburb. I don't know. It's part of the chaos that's going on all around us.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderfully, wonderfully convoluted process that's been made more complicated by every single stakeholder, by the sounds of it.
Absolutely.
But for once, it sounds as though the casino companies have just been playing it really straight and going, well, you know, yeah, we'd quite like to do this. Here's our ideas.
and I've got to credit Neil Bloom, the real estate developer who owns all of the Rivers casinos, and his bid. He's standing staunch. He was fighting this issue with the city on the sports book. And I suspect Bloom, with his native, he's a Chicago guy, he's been here, he's built his corporation here. I suspect he's got a little swag. And his proposal, you know, is probably going to be the one to stand out above the other ones and will probably end up being licensed for the Chicago casino.
You think because he has swag or because it's just a really sexy idea that he's put forward there?
Yes. And yes,
I see.
I think he's a strong proposal. I think his McCormick Place one was like a $2 billion proposal. He had 2,600 slot machine positions and 190 table games.
Wow.
to build a $2 billion venue, entertainment, hotel rooms, although you don't need many hotel rooms because you have so many hotels in and around that area already. But I'm sure they would be high-end for his high-end players.
Sounds pretty sexy.
I think, but it will take forever. Why? Because it's the city. And every step of the way will be somebody, you know, is trying to figure out a way and how they can get their piece of the action.
Are you getting a piece of the action, Tom?
God, I wish. I described it as every political hack getting involved, although my phone never rang. Well, you called, but that was it.
I'm really sorry, Tom. I'll try and get you in on it.
Yeah, it is worth watching. It's just great political theater.
Yeah, I think it's all that is bad about political theater summed up in one event in one city. But what I love is that this isn't a lot of back and forth about whether to make it legal. That part's been done. That's usually the difficult part.
Well, that took decades.
Everything since.
I mean, I literally can tell you, sitting in the boardroom of the Bowling Corporation 30 years ago, and the debate of could casinos ever be legalized in a city the size of Chicago, and in the Bally boardroom, and the debate was then, and it's literally taken 3 decades to come up with the answer, and the answer is yes, and they are going to build a casino right in here.
I need you to go back and find out how many people that were in that boardroom are still alive. And just, if your position was yes, you need to just go, see, I told you.
Yeah, you know what? I may be the only one still upright. But
that, well, only because you were just, you were merely the tea boy at the time. It was your first job out of school.
I was bringing in coffee and things like that, delivering it to important people. So,
like a little urchin on the streets of London. More ice for your drink, sir. I can totally picture it.
That minus the accent, yeah, that was it.
I did go a bit Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins there, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Tom, thank you very much for joining us, bringing us up to date on all things Chicago-y. Sweet home Chicago, as the late, great John Belushi once sang.
Are you
going to
play the music on the out? You know, a little Chicago music going out on this?
I'm just going to sing it, Tom.
Then I'm hanging up.
Tom, thank you.
You're more than welcome, sir. Be safe.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Gambling Files, please visit the website www.thegamblingfiles.com. Like, subscribe, tell your friends. Tell your friends to tell their friends. Tell your colleagues. Same, they can tell their other colleagues. Tell your parents. Tell their parents. Tell your children. Tell your children to tell their friends, because some of them might grow up to work in the gambling industry. It all helps. Thank you, and we'll see you in 2022.